This hour is supported by Robbins Kaplan, LLP, dedicated to redefining excellence for high-stakes litigation representation in Indian Country.
Live from Macho Blue Earth, Robbins Kaplan Studios, Native Roots Radio.
We went to all the powwows when we were young. At that time, children could not dance. Only people over 50 years of age could dance. Most people do not know this, that the government forbid children to dance Indian. And that was so they could wipe out the culture of the young people, and then finally the new generation would never know what
happened. I'm a member of the American Indian Movement, and I'm from the indigenous nations of the Western Hemisphere.
We American Indians, we can be anything we want to be, except American Indians.
You were here long before any of us were here.
Buju, everybody. My name is Peggy Flanagan. Guabagani Gadikagna Njujaba. I'm from the White Earth Nation, and my family's the Wolf Clan.
There was trouble in Custer, South Dakota yesterday.
That the American Indian Movement is a very proud, continuing part of American Indian society. I thank you.
So what I tell you is that we are not backing down. We are here, we will stand here, because we have been here for 10,000 years. We're the home team, and we're not going anywhere. We're rich.
Hey, Kutagi, to all my friends and relatives in four directions. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake. Ahu, Ho-Chunk Raja, Wakunjahade, Hingadena.
Hey, as always, this show is dedicated to those who give back and fight back for our people. We are the resistance. We are awake. This is going to be a special show, and Wendy, I'd really like Wendy to lead it off again, but we're going to have, the whole show is going to be dedicated to John Greendeer.
John Greendeer is great. Tell us who he is, Robert.
Yeah, he's a former president of Ho-Chunk Nation, and he's also former executive director of the Heritage Preservation, and now he's a health and wellness coordinator of Ho-Chunk Nation. And we asked him a few years ago to give us some updates and some history, and he's come through in a big way.
Yeah, he's awesome, and he's talks a lot about a lot of different things, and he's very well versed, and he's really fun to listen to.
Yeah.
He really is.
Right. Hey, all things are our relatives. What we do to everything, we do to ourselves. All is one. I want to introduce my awesome and beautiful wife, Wendy Pilot. Wendy has been an animal advocate for many years. She is a volunteer Minnesota State Council member for the Humane Society of the United States, and she works on animal issues at the state level. Tell us your name, Wendy.
Hi, my name is Hanaji Hihani, and that means cares for them. And I just have a really quick update, and the update is from the Humane Society of the United States, A Humane World. And this is Kitty Block's blog, and Kitty Block is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. And this is breaking news from Monday, February 24th, 2020. China, on Monday, announced a ban on buying and selling wild animals for food, taking its most decisive action yet to halt a trade that has been implicated in the global coronavirus crisis and that causes immense suffering for hundreds of thousands of animals each year, including endangered wildlife. China's wildlife trade has decimated populations of certain wild animals within the country and in other nations, and it is the most monumental announcement Perfect. Concerning animal welfare since it banned ivory in 2017. Monday's decision has the potential to affect even more animals than the ivory ban because the sheer volume and number of animals involved in the wildlife trade. And it couldn't have come sooner. The coronavirus outbreak, believed to have originated in a live animal market in the city of Wuhan, is spreading to other countries. It has already claimed more than 26 100 lives, most of them in China, and sickened more than 79,000 people worldwide. So this is good news for all the endangered species that are being eaten in China and all the people who are being affected by the coronavirus.
Well, you know, it's just like old times here for you, leading off with an update for our sacred animals. And I really appreciate that, Wendy. And we wanted to squeeze an update on there.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Robert.
So, hey, let's take a listen here. This is one of the first ones that we got from John, and he's talking about the government history and such of Ho-Chunk Nation. Let's take a listen.
Jigay, hana, chini, kadagi, we know. My name is John Greendeer. I am once again excited to send each of you a warm greeting. Also excited to be on the radio. This is kind of cool. A lot of people don't know this. I'm actually a licensed ham radio operator. Yep, let that sink in. KD9ETK is my call. But it has nothing to do with me being on the radio. So it's actually quite useless information. So I thought it was kind of cool, but it'll get more relevant from here, I promise. Today we get to talk about something a little bit more in my wheelhouse. I am the executive director of heritage preservation for the Ho-Chunk Nation, which is a pretty expansive title, but if you look at what it covers, that's even more broad. I always ask folks, you know, what do you think of when you hear heritage preservation? And, you know, some folks, the response is, you know, powwows, drums, songs, music, feathers, regalia, you know, dances. Others, you know, might be more on the naturalist side of the spectrum and say, well, all the things that predate, you know, pre-colonial contact, you know, and our rivers, our land, our mountains, our you know, forests, vegetation, animals, all these things that, you know, those are the things we need to preserve. You know, others, you know, look at it from a more scholarly point of view in terms of the historical context or political, you know, and it's about sovereignty. It's about your legal disposition as a nation. It's what you can do to self-govern. So what is it? It's all of those and more. And even nowadays, preservation really is synonymous with everything that falls under quote culture. So we have a lot of things that that we do oversee. Now, as a preservationist, those are very distinct. Culture being something that you can't really kill or anything like that. It's a part of your daily life. How you brush your teeth, when you go to school, who gets the TV first, all that stuff is a part of your culture. Your home has one, your work has one, your school, your church. But more importantly, you know, we look at preserving our heritage. And these are things that probably weren't intended to change, like, you know, your songs, your stories, you know, your fundamental beliefs, principles, family, clan, colors, those types of things. And so those are kind of more in the area. And while it does seem like they do overlap, because they do, we do try to be more distinctive to focus on some of those elements that might be in danger of being lost. So when I started as the executive director for heritage preservation, I thought like I was going to be like zapped down, you know, with a bag over my head, and I'm going to go down 7 flights into this, you know, dark, eerie area where we had this big, giant, massive storage unit of all of our songs and stories and everything that defined us historically. And, you know, it was not a scene out of the X-Files by any means. We don't have all that stuff. Yes, there are recordings. Yes, there are photographs. Yes, there are, but there certainly isn't a place where you can just walk into and you know, plug in your USB and just fill your whole world up with history and knowledge. We are remnants of an oral tradition of vastly, you know, substantive oral tradition of songs and stories and things that identify you as a family. And, you know, I'd mentioned before in a previous show that, you know, a lot of these things were severed, not, you know, just simply by boarding schools, but, you know, a lot of, you know, forces in westernization that have really changed our daily culture. You know, today we can't say we are you know, living the life of those of us and our people in the past. You know, we're too busy working two jobs just to be broke and, you know, getting our kids off to school so we can be conveniently late for work and probably unwrapping more meals than we should be, you know. So there are, there's just, you know, certain things that lifestyles that we have now that, you know, probably don't synchronize with, you know, the people that we came from who really built their life or their way of life, which Ho-Chunks will call Woshka, around simplicity, you know, food, water, shelter, things that we kind of take for granted nowadays. But if we were ever forced to go back to that, there's probably a good chance we'd have a bit of a struggle. Yes, we could eat deer if you can get one, or catch fish if you can catch one, or make nets or make hooks. You know, we didn't have necessarily the obligation to learn survival skills. You know, that's what they would be for us today, but to them it was just simply living. So I don't know how long it would take us to learn today, but you know, back then that way of life wasn't something you learned in a week, day, or you know, years, or even a lifetime. It took many lifetimes. You know, we go back, you know, thousands and thousands of years, and you know, our oral tradition has us, you know, placed back into the red banks of the Green Bay, but you know, we don't really know when that was. You know, we can certainly, you know, use science to determine, you know, when, you know, the human existence took place into this area, but we can't really verify, you know, lean too heavily on archaeology or belief system. We just have to accept the fact that we don't know. And if we were meant to know, we would. But I can say that, you know, when we start going back to, you know, our history, and, you know, I hate to surprise everyone, but history doesn't start when a white guy sets foot on a piece of earth. You know, a lot of times we do that when we say, we're going to talk about history. Well, it's going to be George Washington or Ben Franklin or Christopher Columbus. And you know, no, history starts, you know, way before that, you know, before we can even think of. And so, you know, we discipline ourselves to make sure that, you know, we don't think in that Western manner. This is how and who we are. So, to give you a scale of that, you know, one of the exercises that, you know, we'll provide in making sure people understand the heritage of and where we are, we pull this 50-foot rope out and have the children kind of hold that as far out as they can. And that rope, in this context, only represents 14,000 years, you know, where we're dated back to, at least, you know, on the science end of things. But we introduce, you know, things like, you know, the projectile points and some of the stone tools all the way, you know, these are the historic areas where they, you know, prehistoric areas where they didn't have, you know, recording devices or written languages, those types of things. And people will actually get a chance to see the scale of this because, you know, every foot of that rope represents about approximately 280 years. Which means that, you know, if you went 2 feet, you've already passed the arrival of Columbus to the Americas, you know. And so you have to think back from those 48 feet. Oh, my God, there was a lot of time between then and now. We are not the first. We're not fresh off the boat here. We've been here for such a long time. And the reason why we have made it to this day is because of those elements of our heritage. So making sure that those things are passed down to our folks is probably our biggest mission, to make sure that there's a connection there. And there is. And that's the amazing thing about it is, you know, these things that you know, we credit our ancestors to, we have those things. We never lost them. We may not have to engage those, but there are certain things that, you know, we do in heritage preservation and cultural resources and language that really show that connection is there and it's as strong as it's ever been before. So whenever we learn how to say our name and our language and use it, whenever we learn how to craft an item that has some utility and we see people using it, it's there. So, you know, I don't, you know, it doesn't take long for people to realize, I they get really amped up on things like this. But you know, this connection that we have, you know, they can't take that away from us. That's who we are. We are these people that, you know, that they try to separate us from. So, you know, heritage preservation is really about making sure that we have a strong connection and a strong identity with who we are, because that really is what determines our success in the modern Western world. And it's what determined our success in the prehistoric times as well. So heritage preservation does include a lot. And, you know, I'm always discouraged because, you know, I don't know the things that people come to ask me, or, you know, the people I work with, they say the same thing. We don't know everything. We'd like to be able to help. But, you know, one of the things that they talk about, you know, in our way of life, and I hope I don't butcher this too much, but, you know, when they say that Ho-Chunga to Woshka ke ineki, ya oncha, ki kara chegi, hi ain chak shinawi, you know, we're not doing this alone. That's, you know, we don't have this all by ourselves. It's with our group, our family, our clan, that we can all do this. And, you know, this is knowledge that, you know, I think is really important, that no one person knows all of this, but we all know a little bit. And when we come together, that's how we come to know everything. You know, we can't do it all ourselves, but if everyone does a little bit, then it can get done. And so, you know, these are things that are really, you know, lean on heavily, and making sure that the circle, the group is wider, and there's more people in there rather than just a small number of people that are, you know, carrying that burden and trying to carry this on, because that's never going to work. So it really is about being together. It's really about working together, sharing together. And, you know, the best way to do it is to look at our brothers and sisters as, you know, what they are. They're our family. And so together, that's what defines who we are. And that's going to define what the success of heritage preservation is. So again, I want to thank everyone for allowing me to share just, you know, a 10,000 foot view of what heritage preservation is, and let you know that no matter what we're asked, we may not have an answer, but the minute, you know, we're done talking, we're thinking of how to find that answer for each of you. So again, Hanachekji, Hinagigiwi, Wainumpwi, Wahaje. Thank you.
Pinigigi John Greendeer for that great piece. You're listening to the best of John Greendeer on Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Anin, I'm Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, and you are listening to Native Roots Radio.
Here is the best of Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake with John Greendeer of Ho-Chunk Nation.
Aho, hana chini kadigi we know. Jige mashu skahi gaide. Ho chunk hijo, waonje. Eske chaki kadish, waonje. Eske hapte e. Ho chunk woshka hiske. Anaga hi kuroke hara magra honigi dagik shenain. Eske jagu hi hekshenaina hanaina huida. Eske woinap we wahaje. To my friends and family, and to all the listeners at Native Roots Radio, thanks for having me on. This is really exciting. I get excited to think about what should we talk about and how far should we go. So today I've, you know, was really inspired from the recent events. First and foremost, the world waking up in our world after the summer solstice, our new year, our planting season. The birds are back, and, you know, the robins were kind of miffed because they might have come back a little too early because of our second and third winter. But you know what? That's life. The waters are raging. You know, things are vibrant and happening. And so I think it's worth capturing in this little bit of moment and having a little couple words on, you know, our Ho-Chunk traditional perspective. I also had mentioned I'm going to talk a little bit about our earth and about the clan system. I'd mentioned I'm a member of the Deer Clan and a very proud member, and what that actually means in real life. It, not around tribal election times where you find out what clan peoples are, but people that are actually living it, like my Ho-Chunk father, Ure Kumaniga, Bill Greendeer. Like, he's been out there speaking on behalf of things that don't have a voice, like our trees and our plants, our soils, our fish.
and water, and he's made it something. He's done more with his little beat up truck, you know, and his, you know, tea and berries and things like that going out there than a Fortune 500 PR team. So I'm inspired by that. I'm inspired by a recent show with Winona LaDuke, you know, really discussing environmental justice and you know, alternatives and the hemp industry. So, you know, we've got folks that are out there, you know, on iconic levels that are doing things, changing, you know, behaviors, going backwards to go forwards. And so, you know, that's kind of my inspiration here. And so, you know, how do we look at this as a little old me type of thing? So this is where it really, I'm really happy to be Ho-Chunk, really happy to be a member of the Deer Clan, because it really is about making sure that your lifestyle and your focus is ensuring that these gifts that we're given, that's what my Jaji Bill says. He doesn't call them, he says, you got to quit calling them resources, call them gifts. That's what they were given. They were gifts, you know, for us to use. And so that these gifts were passed along for generations as they were for us. So as members of the Deer Clan, in as far as back as I know, and maybe things could have been different back then, but, you know, our tasks were fairly simple. Our tasks were to be servants of the people. And that's a big task, obviously, you know, that could be entail a lot of things, but also to be messengers, primarily to our upper clans, and also to be what they call environmentalists. And I don't know if that's the actual word they were thinking of, but we are caretakers of our grandmother Earth. This was our grandmother. We take care of her now as she's taking care of us. So that's the relationship that we have. And when we stop doing our role, she's not going to be able to fulfill the role of taking care of us anymore. And, you know, as modern and as assimilated as I think I've become, I try not to let that lose my thoughts in everything that we do. And I think there's a lot of people the same way. So now, as environmentalists, you know, what does that mean? And that covers so much here, but let's just go back. So we've got a vibrant time, you know, we've got the spring, our new year, all these things happening, planting season upon us. You know, also we've got construction season upon us, and, you know, so we've got a lot of things, moving and waking up from this kind of long gray winter. And I think that kind of put people down in the doldrums, you know, because they weren't really ready for our second and third winters. The robins certainly weren't. They kind of looked like they were messed up. We went out and bought some, mealworms and got some, food out there to make sure that they made it through, because they came home a little early and they probably should have stayed where it was warm. But nonetheless, you know, they probably wouldn't have done that if we didn't screw something up somewhere along the line. So so as an environmentalist, and you try to look at this, well, what do we capture? Because if we sat here and had a conversation about the environment, someone's going to talk about recycling. Someone's going to talk about climate change or global warming. Someone's going to talk about flooding. Someone's going to talk about beaver dams. Someone's going to talk about, you know, environmental justice. And you know, and so all of a sudden, you've got this pinata that's busted all over the place, and you've got the scattered discussion, and it has to happen. And that, you know, because I think if you really want to make change and effective change, you've pretty much got to put all the tools on the table and start to organize how you're going to look at things. Now, there's a lot of different ways, you know, a PR firm might look at it a little bit more differently than an environmental services firm, who might look at it differently than a government council person might look at it. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways to organize this. There's also ways to look at it in a matter of perspective. Where do I sit in this role of an environmentalist or a member of the Deer Clan? You know, on the global perspective, you know, we've got space dust and matter on the universal side. We've got climate change. We've got melting ice caps. We've got trash that's just being dumped into the oceans that to nth degrees. We've got, you know, and so, these are the parts where you start feeling powerless, useless, that there's nothing I can do. That's over there. That's not really my concern type of thing. You've got things that are happening nationally. You know, we live in the nation that creates the most waste and the most byproduct. And, you know, we have done little to mitigate not only the consumption, but also the waste and material from that consumption as well. We've got states that impose different types of energy and efficiency standards. Some regulate it, some don't. Some are more, you know, feel like if you try to do anything on the environmental, unquote, side, it's going to affect you on the economic development side, and the economy is going to go down. And so we've got people scared into that. We've got local economies where things, you know, depend on, you know, commerce and being able to move materials through certain areas. And a lot of times, you know, the infrastructure was not made for these types of commercial upgrades, and of the corporations that are put here are subsidized, and they're not at fault for, you know, bringing on the contamination levels or the road construction. And so, you know, that falls on the shoulders of the local taxpayers and the residents here. And then we start getting into your local communities, and then your households, and then your individual practices. So you start looking at it different layers of, you know, where am I going to have the most impact? And now it does get a little confusing, a little harrowing, as I kind of feel too myopic to have any types of change. So this is where it really helps to be, to have some grounding in your clan system, your it's more than a moral obligation. It's what your responsibility was in order to keep a people alive for centuries. And so this is where we're going back to. As Deer Clan members, we have the ability to educate, to teach people about their local environment and some of the things that they can do to reduce their carbon footprint, to have least impact, to allow species to exist and just be themselves. And, you know, part of that is making sure that the messaging, which is a part of our responsibility as well, is key to the audience as well. And sometimes that's not always the case. We kind of lit drop everyone or guilt people into things. And we really want people to make change, positive change, because it's the right thing to do, not because they're compelled or forced to do that. And the best way to do that has always been through education. So we do have to take on that role as an educator as well as a messenger. And so I think the first thing we need to do is identify what the real issue is. A while back, several years ago, my little brother, David Greendeer, Nachke Hunka, he really captured a notion that I never even realized. If I found myself doing this and wasting a lot of energy, fixing problems I didn't know existed. He said, before you can begin to fix something, you have to put the problem on the table. What is wrong? What's the thing? You know, what's wrong with the environment? You know, and really makes you think about, okay, I need to actually be real clear. I can't politicize this. I need to be able to be straight up. What is the problem, so that we can actually figure out the solution? And so that's probably one of the first things. And those problems are going to be a little bit different for each community or individual that gets discussed. Now, in our teachings, you know, our whole way of life will always draw us to pause from our regular, busy, stress-filled, I work three jobs just to be broke, can't get my kids to school on time kind of lifestyles, and just take a small break here and go back to the original sources, the original places of our lodge, of our fireplace, of our tobacco, of our language, you know, of our earth, our trees, our water, and make sure that the things that we're doing, you know, that we're what we're offering tobacco for, is to make sure that they remain healthy and that we maintain a relationship among those, no matter what things that we have ahead of us on the road, and we ask for help, and we make sure that there's sacrifice involved in by what we're doing or what we're offering to make sure that these things can continue to exist in a kind of a circular pattern. So, you know, that's probably the best way to describe it for, you know, someone who has to jump in at chapter four of this. There's a lot more meaning of and origin where this comes from, but making sure that, you know, we acknowledge that this earth is here for us to use. It was not here for us to own or to destroy. And I think that, you know, that very concept or philosophy does start to get obscured when you start looking and comparing whether or not the health of a field or a lake, stream, riparian area is can be quantified into a dollar amount or can be moved aside for development for the greater good or the, you know, the substantial benefit of a local community. And so it does kind of borderline, you know, put us in a juxtaposition with making sure that we have the value for our environment and our grandmother Earth at the top of the list. This is something I think we share universally with a lot of folks. And it isn't just, you know, organizations and environmental advocacy groups. These are residents, people that are growing up in their communities, that are raising small children, that want clean water, that deserve clean water, you know, that like to go out and recreate and enjoy, you know, the scenic beauty of what we have. And this is why Wisconsin is just an A-lister for people that, you know, want to come out and enjoy the world. You know, mining, mineral extraction companies, they don't like Wisconsin because, you know, they are looked at as a threat. And so you've got Perrier, Billiton, BHP, all these organizations that have come out to do this, and they're realizing the fight is going to be tough and it's going to be long. And I don't want to say that it's simply because we like our quote natural resources. I really believe that there is an inherent attachment that we have to our grandmother, and that it will continue. And people like Bill, and people like Winona, and people like and organizations that are out there for the greater good understand that, and they get it. And it's about making sure the message is out there. So these come from our old ways that we, you know, still offer tobacco, that we still, you know, light those fires. We still say those things that we were told thousands of years ago. And we do that with the best intent. We don't control this. We can simply just do our part and take it as far as we can. But, you know, the existential danger is one day we may not be able to light those fires, pour that tobacco on behalf of these spirits and items, or speak the language. And so this is why it's so important to continue this legacy. So once again, I want to thank you all for this little piece of the time for the show. I know it wasn't as substantive as one might like to hear or enjoy, but that's the show. I'm always happy to take any calls at some point and, you know, have some dialogue and listen. You know, I think I enjoy learning as much as I enjoy sharing. So everyone, thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful day, and get outside.
Pinigigi John Greendeer for that great piece. You're listening to the best of John Greendeer on Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Hi, this is Representative Charisse Davids from Kansas. I'm Ho-Chunk, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
Here is the best of Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake with John Greendeer of Ho-Chunk Nation.
Hello, and once again, my name is John Greendeer, a.k.a. Mashuska, with my intermittent contribution to Native Roots Radio. Thanks once again for this incredible honor to contribute this very open palette discussion on issues in Indian country. So one of the issues that is near and dear to my heart is dealing with Native American health and health within our communities, particularly with obesity, childhood obesity, healthy weights, and type 2 diabetes. And I have just been recently welcomed into the Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Health and Community Wellness. And I'm actually really excited. I got my boss here who has been overseeing the program. Her name is Sarah Peterson. She is the Community Health Director. So she's overseeing health and wellness and a lot of the different programs the nation has employed, and including some of the grants. But, you know, more importantly, what does this look like on the ground in our communities? What types of trends is she seeing, especially related to how our communities are today as to how they, you know, we believe they were prior to 1492, our traditional diets, our traditional practices of hunting and gathering. So today I will allow Ms. Peterson to introduce herself and kind of discuss a little bit of what she's seen in her profession. So we have Sarah Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, John. So like you stated, I am the Community Health Director. The biggest difference that I have seen in Native communities that I've had the pleasure of work with is the shift from eating to live to living and to eat. You know, in pre-colonial times, we had to hunt and gather, and this often meant that the hunting parties would be gone from their families for days, weeks, or even months at a time. when they returned home, there was often a celebratory ceremony to honor the hunters, but also the animals that we had taken. We honored our food because it gave us life, and it didn't matter if it was a plant or animal, we gave thanks. This was a natural way of being in balance with the earth, water, and the animal beings around us. Now in this modern world that we live in, we are unbalanced. We no longer have that spiritual relationship with our food. This is primarily due to the traumas that Native Americans have endured for hundreds of years. Now, I think that it can be said for any race of people that the relationship with food has changed. Food gives people what they may lack in other areas of their lives, such as comfort, security, control, and stress relief. And unfortunately, though, when we are talking about food and the changes to our diets, now fast food is easy and convenient, and who wouldn't want a little convenience in their lives?
We have fry bread, we have Big Macs, we have high-octane coffee, we have... You know, as you'd mentioned, a diet of convenience. And, you know, we're raising children in this culture to accept this as the norm. And, you know, maybe perhaps explain this massive challenge that you and your team have going out there, not just, you know, trying to lower the amount of diabetes and getting people more active, but how do you actually... change a culture of how we've been westernized over what type of programs are you seeing that have been successful?
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest focus that we've been trying to gear our programs towards is to make sure that we're not only trying to change what you're eating, but we have to change the narrative. And we need to first focus on healing the mind. You know, our Native communities, they're faced with so many barriers and struggles in how we live our day-to-day lives. And one of the largest that we face is generational trauma and the damage that was caused during removals, boarding schools, government food handouts, and poverty. The list could go on. And until we can bring our traditions and values back into our day-to-day living, we're going to remain unbalanced.
So how do you see the grants portion and the... I mean, this one might hit you in left field a little bit, but how do you see, how do you report on the success of any one of these programs in terms of measurables and saying, this is a program I've seen working? What's your idea of how you can show the improvement within the health of our Indian communities with the programs that you oversee?
Well, thank you for that one. Yeah, so... all of our programs, the vast majority of our programs that we have coming out of community health, they're prevention based. So a lot of the grants that we have and that we receive, they're prevention based. So we have to try to come up with some sorts of measurables that we are able to report back to our grant managers. The biggest one that we are able to say is that we have all of these organic gardens that we have in all of our communities. So we can see the number of families that are coming out to each one of these gardens, and they're picking blueberries and they're picking strawberries, and they're increasing the number of fresh fruits and vegetables that are going into their diets. So we would see that as a success. We can also track through our fitness membership program on some of the users that use it on a regular basis. We do have some that we're able to report back and say, hey, you know what? This person went from being extremely overweight and unmotivated to now they're running the New York City Marathon. We do have a tribal member that is able to do that. So we do have those successes that we are able to report on, even though it is a prevention-based grant.
So about 15 years ago, the federal government really focused on the diabetes prevention as well, developing programs and, you know, granting money out to organizations that were making these custom programs for their communities. We had a spike in the success of that. We saw people jumping onto different programs. The incentives were there for them to join in. They probably, some of them experienced some of their own rewards for the efforts that they put in. But all of a sudden, you start to see us slipping back into this trend where, and it isn't just simply putting the weight back on, but jumping back into a lifestyle that probably doesn't have the healthy choices that they once had. And so we had this flash in the pan of what, the financial and the other resource support had on Indian country, but now that that positive impact doesn't seem to be evident anymore. Can you explain what's happening in our communities that's bringing us back to this?
You know, the one thing that we are able to say with our special diabetes grant for Indians is that over the last 6 years, we have maintained our prevalence rate. While that hasn't gone down, we've been able to maintain that even throughout the Bemidji area that we work out of. So it is definitely a positive that we're not increasing. We're also not backtracking either. So the biggest issue that we are seeing now is the fact that we have people that are addicted to sugar, just like any other sort of substance abuse. You know, sugar is one of those things that once you get used to having it in your daily diet, your body starts needing it and they start requiring it. So when we have people coming through our programs and they're suddenly trying to cut out sugar or cut out carbs or whatever it may be in their diets, they're struggling because they go through withdrawals just like any other sort of substance. And that leads to, you know, people backtracking and they start slipping sugar and carbs and stuff back into their diet just to make them feel good again.
So is this something like the New Year's resolution phenomena where people are motivated and have this spike that they really want to see themselves and they go out and push themselves, completely change their diets and aren't really prepared for that? Is this something that you see is kind of very much akin to what's happening in Indian country when they do take on special health initiatives, that they aren't really preparing themselves mentally for the big changes ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not something that everybody talks about is, you know, we talk that you need to cut out your sugars, you need to cut down your carbs, you need to increase your fruits and vegetable intake, but nobody really talks about what your body is going to go through. You know, I tell people, you know, you got to go through the suck before it gets better. Typically, you know, there is a withdrawal period, especially if you're looking at cutting something out cold turkey. Our registered dietitians that we work with on a daily basis, they're willing to do one-on-ones and kind of help people through this and make attainable small changes into their diets so they don't necessarily set themselves up for failure by cutting sugars and carbs cold turkey.
Another thing, when people are making some healthy decisions and starting to trend themselves to a healthy lifestyle, one of the things that people use to comfort themselves in this new change is to class themselves as busy people, saying, well, I don't really have to work out too much because I'm really busy. I'm running around throughout the day. How do you compare that with someone who's actually on a health program?
Yeah, I think the best way that you can categorize that is that everybody has a busy lifestyle. But until you make that focus where you're putting it in your calendar and your phone buzzes and it says, hey, you know what, it's time to get up and it's time to go for a run or whatever you have scheduled for that day, whether it's a structured fitness class or you're going to go hop on the bike for 20 miles, John, or whatever it may be. You need to have that where it's in your calendar and you're committing to it. It has to be a commitment because not only does that set yourself up for success in your exercise program, but that also sets you up for success in your daily lives as well, because now you're prioritizing your life and you're making priorities within your life to get healthy. And that, of course, is a healthy living habit.
And so finally, I think the thing that should be said, and we've both seen this in the field, is making sure that our tribal communities aren't victims of this epidemic because they're considered lazy or because they're inactive. You know, I want to believe that it's just the opposite. And there are real scientific and biological reasons why this issue affects our communities greater than any other community. Is that something that, you know, you could share with us?
Yeah. So as far as talking about stuff along those lines, you're focusing on kind of the social and determinants of health that minorities often struggle with. One of the largest things that we have to focus on is the fact that, you know, specifically with the Ho-Chunk Nation, we've been geared towards reducing those social determinants and economic determinants that we have. I mean, we now have walking trails and we have all these programs that are available for tribal members. It's really just changing that mindset that this is something that we're going to do. And unfortunately for Native populations, diabetes and obesity have been one of those things that have been normalized. It's no longer seen as something that's bad. It's something that's going to happen. You know, we have youth out there that they've watched their gaga go through amputations or their choka and, you know, blindness, whatever it may be, that goes along with diabetes and obesity. And it's just one of those things that they see as normal. They're going to grow up. They're going to end up gaining weight. They're going to get diabetes. They're going to have amputations. And that's the way their life's going to be. So we really have to, you know, gear our programs towards reaching the youth and helping them through this to see that it's not a normal behavior.
For a lot of the families that are out there in the communities or out in the urban setting, what's your recommendation for individuals or families or households, communities that want to make some positive health changes? What's one of the first resources that they can go to start getting educated on some of the positive changes that they can make and something that they can really commit to?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have our Ho-Chunk Nation Health Department page. We have all of our divisions on there under community health. You're going to find our nursing programs. You're going to find health and wellness. You're also going to find our dietitians and all those contacts that you need to reach out to. There's always the availability to reach out to your local legislator as well. A lot of our programs, I'm more than willing to have our employees go out to these different communities and do presentations. And we always try to partner with local UW extensions as well as the school systems. So we're readily available if people are willing to reach out.
Well, thank you very much. Again, this is a really important issue. I really believe that, you know, it isn't just about weight. It isn't just about your A1C and you know, your physical fitness, how far you can run or bike. It really is about strengthening the community, empowering the community. I believe that when you have a healthy body and a healthy mind that, you know, things like, you know, education and, you know, your professional successes, all of those wishes, your academic goals are reached better with a clean body and a clean mind. So today I am extra grateful to have Ms. Sarah help me out with this contribution to Native Roots Radio. So thank you. Maybe we'll have you on once again. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, John.
Kinigigi, John Green Deer, for all those updates. It's been a great show so far, Wendy.
It really has. He's so much fun to listen to.
All right, you're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and we're going to go into hour two. We'll be right back after these short messages. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is the best of.
It's a good day to be indigenous.
Get up, stand up.
They are going to become more brutal.
Because all the hippies were trying to be Indians anyway.
They're going to become more repressive because it's a matter of dollars and their illusionary concepts of power.
Hey, Victor.
We must live in balance with the earth.
And also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee.
I am awake.
Welcome back to Hour 2 of Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake. I'm your host, Wakunja Hare. All things are relatives. What we do to everything, we do to ourselves. I want to introduce my awesome and beautiful wife, Wendy Pilot. Wendy has been an animal advocate for many years. She's a volunteer Minnesota State Council member for the Humane Society of the United States, and she works on animal issues at the state level. Welcome, Wendy, and what a show we've had so far. Huh?
Yeah, it's been a great show. But what I want to do today is kind of give my last push for Humane Lobby Day. Excuse my voice. So Humane Lobby Day is a event that the Humane Society of the United States holds every year. And what we get to do is we go to the state capitol and we meet with our legislators and we talk to them about humane bills that we want to have passed in Minnesota. So this Monday, February 24th, is the last day to register for Humane Lobby Day. And you could go online to Humane Lobby Day 2020 Minnesota, and you could sign up. It's $10 to sign up, and what the $10 gets you is a lunch. We give a nice lunch and coffee in the morning, and we have a speaker program, and you are set up with a time and a time to meet with your legislator. Usually you'll go with a group of people and you're going to be talking about certain issues, which we'll talk about in just a minute. And we will be at the Christ Lutheran Church on Capitol Hill. It's 105 University Avenue, and it's right outside the state building and the state Capitol. And it's a lot of fun. I think this is my sixth year doing it. And I get to meet with my legislators and talk to them about bills that we'd like to have passed in Minnesota.
It's like the northwest corner of the Capitol.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And it's a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of like-minded people there. I think last year we had about 120 people, and I think that's about as big as the venue holds. So we were sold out. So we hope to sell out this year, too. So log on and get that done by February 24th. It's a lot of fun. It's a very empowering day.
And when you say sold out, it's a free event.
Well, it's $10. It's $10
okay.
to
cool.
sign up, and the $10 gets you a lunch and the program, and we rent the space, so it's just kind of a reimbursement, so it doesn't, you know, cost anybody any money, and it's $10, and it's really cheap, so it's totally awesome.
That
yeah.
is awesome.
But one of the things that we're going to be bringing up to our legislators of this session is because Minnesota wants to push a bill for the pet adoption. So, Robert, if you remember, last year I testified in front of the St. Paul City Council, and we passed an ordinance that there should not be any pet stores in St. Paul selling dogs and cats that were derived from puppy mills or kitten mills. And we got it passed by our St. Paul City Council.
That was very, very powerful, and you had a very powerful presentation.
Well, I brought a picture of our Gracie. Gracie is one of our dogs. She's a little white Maltese, and she spent 7 years in a puppy mill. So for those of you who don't know what a puppy mill is a large-scale breeding facility for dogs and cats. So dogs are just kept in cages year after year, and they're bred over and over again. And then their puppies are sold online and in pet stores. So we were really lucky to get the St. Paul ordinance passed. So St. Paul is not allowed to sell any dogs and cats in a pet store derived from a puppy mill or a kitten mill. Eden Prairie also has this ordinance, and so does Roseville. But what we're going to talk to our legislators about is getting the whole state of Minnesota finally to the point where there won't be any pet stores in the whole state of Minnesota that will sell dogs and cats derived from these horrible, horrendous, inhumane places.
Horrible, horrible.
Really horrible. And there's three states right now who have this ordinance passed. It's Maryland, California, and Maine. So those three states, there are no pet stores that sell dogs and cats from puppy mills, which is really exciting. And this is what we want to do here in Minnesota.
So there's a stat, Wendy, that you have come up over the years that said that if every person has X amount.
Oh, yeah. If every person, not every family, but every person in the United States, every person in the United States has to have four dogs each to combat the dog overpopulation in the United States. And that would get rid of the dog overpopulation if everybody in the United States had four dogs.
So we want people to adopt and get dogs like that, like the dogs that you're up champion, because we don't want breeders breeding more and more dogs.
Exactly. And we want to get these dogs out of these horrible puppy mills where our little Gracie, a little white Maltese, spent 7 years of her life, and she had a litter every twice a year, because those dogs can breed twice a year. And her puppies were sold to pet stores and online. And after 7 years, after her little broken body was finished, and she never walked on grass. She never went to the vet. No one ever talked a kind word to her. After her 7 years of duty,
she has no teeth now.
Has no teeth. She was auctioned off for $35. Now we have her. We have her now for about 3 years, and it took a really long time for her to get used to walking on grass
and leaves.
She didn't know what leaves were. She would just stop and she would be frozen because she didn't know what they were, whether she could walk on them or not. She never saw leaves before because she spent her whole life in a cage, right? So she honestly, what she did was she jumped over them. But we want people to come to Humane Lobby Day this year, and we want you to talk to your legislator about this new bipartisan bill that would promote pet adoptions in Minnesota. And we want Minnesota to be on the list of those other three states, including Maryland, California, and Maine as humane states.
Who would push against this? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. Unless the only thing I could think of is the agriculture lobbyists who don't want any kind of pushback on like animal agriculture or having pigs in farms or cows in farms. They may rally against this as a part of, you know, animal agriculture. And I'm just saying that because we've had such bad luck trying to get lead bullets banned, which makes sense, right? But the NRA, who takes any type of any pushback at all, even if it's a law that makes sense, they push back. So that would be the only thing I could think of, but you never know.
I think it's funny you bring up that point because I've seen a lot in the news that they're really making the push against lead bullets here in the last couple weeks. So that's maybe bring that up too during hobby or
Humane Lobby Day. Yeah.
Lobby Day.
Yep. Well, it's already the bans are already. What we're going to be talking about are already picked. And this is the most important one that we want to bring to our legislator. And we really want this bill brought. And I don't think that there's anybody who would be against it because really, if you go on Benji's, oh, I wish I could remember the name of it. It's called like Benji's Warehouse. Benji's, it lists all the puppy mills that are in every state. It's called Bailing Out Benji. So if you go to Bailing Out Benji, you could look up your state and a map will come up with all the puppy mills in your state. And the map will also show you how many dogs are in each puppy mill. Yep.
When we were up in Dassel, there was a puppy mill right up there that our groomer told us about that had over 900 dogs.
900 dogs that are there breeding over and over again, who don't leave the cages, who live there, who eat crappy food. That's why our Gracie has no food left, no veterinary care. Their fur and they're matted. They're kept in horrible conditions. But listen, you know what? These puppies bring lots of money. Gracie is a nice little cute little 6-pound dog. She's a little. She doesn't shed. She's hypoallergenic. And people pay big bucks for these dogs. But I'm telling you that the humane thing to do is to adopt a dog. And do not shop at pet stores or online. I'm sure that there are reputable breeders out there, but they're few and far behind to find. And if a breeder doesn't do a home visit, then you know that they're not a good breeder and that they don't really care about where the dog goes.
Always ask to see the mother.
Always and the father. Yeah. Right. You want to see both of the mother and the father.
Wendy, thank you so much for all your work in this. And I know it was hard for you. You've had an operation this week and you've really been a trooper. And I really want to thank everybody out there on Facebook and that's reached out to us and gave you good thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, all the good thoughts and prayers. I really do appreciate it. And I'm on the mend and I'm almost better.
So thanks a lot. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and up next, John Greendeer, Wendy.
Awesome. Love John.
Yeah, we'll be right back after this short message. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is the best of.
Hi, this is Representative Charisse Davids from Kansas. I'm Ho-Chunk, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
We are Elusive.
Welcome back to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Robert Pilot. Hey, we're always excited to have John Greendeer of Wisconsin, former Ho-Chunk president, and with his thoughts. Let's take a listen.
This is Mashuska, John Greendeer, calling to you from central Wisconsin, Stevens Point, a.k.a. God's Country, Packerland area. Sorry, Minnesota. I'm just kidding. Yes, again, this is John Greendeer, infrequent contributor to Native Roots Radio, but very appreciative. Thank you, Robert, Wendy, Curtis, for allowing me to come onto the show with some of my daily dose of random. Today, we have some special guests out here from the campus, UW Stevens Point. And tonight is dinner night, family dinner night for the UWSP Native American students. So we only live a mile away from campus, and we have an opportunity to open our doors and have them come in and share a little bit. We typically have a supper night. Tonight we had some Oneida white corn served with some what we call cowboy bread, old colonizer bread, and we certainly enjoyed that. And then someone went and brought some fancy old desserts. So tonight we have a number of students. I'm going to have them introduce themselves. So here we go.
Bonjour, Bingwe Mayangan Indigenous Kaz, Ma Makua de Dorum, excuse me. Mushkazibi in Nunjiba. My name is Thomas McCutcheon. I'm from Bad River, and I clan is Bear Clan, and from originally from Ashland there, majoring in wild and fire science, minor in forestry, and I am a junior.
Chikoli, Niyakut, Tahashad Howe. I'm Warren Johnson. I'm from originally Green Bay. I'm Oneida. I'm majoring in poli-sci and minoring in history.
Oh, bonjour. Bimosa Gizhi Gumenjitakaz. My name is Forrest Smart from WASA. I'm a health promotion wellness major at UWSP. I'm currently a junior.
Bonjour. Anin Nagabian Nagabo Indigenakaz Makwan Ndudum at Nate Sayas Porter, Bear Clan, and I'm a senior at Stevens Point.
My name is Danette. My clan is Crane. I'm from Wabino. My major is communications with an emphasis in media studies, and I'm a senior.
Bujou, Mayandish Nakaz, Makwando Dam, Odawa Zagagining, and Donjaba. My name is Maya, and I'm a junior at UW Stevens Point.
And we have their support staff here, so here we go.
Bonjour, I am careful in the indigenous class of Swaganin and Dunjuba, Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, Nandao, Wabijation, and Dude. My name is Iris. I work at the university with the Native American students in the Native American Center. I'm from Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin. I am Wabijation clan, and yeah, I'm happy to be here today.
Hi, I'm Rio Greendeer, and I am a freshman in high school.
Sigoli Skanakoga Ngwehue One Oteaga Ni Ho-Chunk Rajda Hanina Ineki Mani Ngaide Chaki Kadachwaonje. My name's Chris Munson. I am a member of the Oneida Nation. I have a name from the Ho-Chunk clan, Deer clan. They call me Ineki Mani. And I happen to live in this house with John and Rio, and we're always really happy to host students and open up our home to people and give a little flavor of home and good food and good laughs.
And so that is our introduction of all my friends, my Hichokotos, my Nijis, and
all my friends around the table. So the question, I guess, you know, it's been a long time since I went to school, but why did you guys decide to go to college? Is there any particular one reason that someone can think about?
Hi, this is Nate. I was actually peer pressured to go to college. I was never going to go, but my guidance counselor, she persisted, said you have to apply to one school, just one school. I applied and I got in.
Well, they got pretty lucky over there for getting you.
Two reasons I went to college. The first one, if I didn't, I'm sure my mom would kill me. The second one is that we really need to have be active within things. That's like why I'm going into poli-sci, because we need to be more active into any kind of political field we can get into. We can't rely on the more or less better term sellers to give us the representation. We need to take it, like, for example, any other group, they have representation, but for us, we have to fight and tooth and nail to get it. And we need to keep doing that.
My grandma was my main inspiration. She had always put in the back of my mind that education would serve as a great tool for Native people to learn the white man's education to essentially use it against them.
Wow, quite the vigilante, huh? You got to sing the AIM song after that one? Woo, lee, 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 right? Well, thanks for those responses. That was pretty cool. Thanks, Iris. So I guess another question is, have you ever been in a classroom or during a lecture and you've had this defining moment where you just realize that you have a completely different perspective than the mainstream? Is there any situation like that experience any of you have had?
I think so. I think when I was in the classroom, one thing I noticed, especially as Native people, that we have a really big respect for someone who's talking or the person that's in charge. So something I notice is I'm really reserved and I listen to the teacher or the professor as best I can, while a lot of other people are busy on their phones or they're talking to other people. They just don't have the kind of respect that I feel like us Native people have.
All right. I like that compliment.
I think I can second that, actually, just because I've been sitting in class and I always try to go to the front row, and I've noticed that people actually do the opposite, where they actually try to go to the back row. It's like, why would you try to go to the back row if you're actually there to learn? You know what I mean?
Did you guys ever get in like conflicts in the middle of your class or get in debates? Were they close enough where you had opposing viewpoints and someone comes swinging around some disrespect and you had to go and check them and burn some sage at them? Or what?
I've had debates with professors even. In the last 2 weeks, I've had 5 or 6 instances where the Bering Strait theory has been told that is a fact to the entire class. And as an indigenous person, naturally you're going to challenge that. So that leads to some pretty interesting conversations.
Did they ever figure out which way the indigenous people were going on the Bering Strait theory?
I have no idea.
Me neither. Grandpa didn't talk about that. So, do you guys ever notice, like, when you're in a class and all of a sudden something in that rare form comes up in reference to Native Americans, and all of a sudden everyone's looking at you and you got to be like the spokesperson for Native American issues and singled out, and it's your opinion that kind of sticks out? And do you ever feel singled out as a Native American in your classes?
I would say sometimes, yeah. I'm in a class, Ethnic Literature and English, an English 300 course, and it's talking about various minorities that make literature within the span of the U.S. history. Predominantly, a lot of them are going to be focusing on issues like at the top of their community. And it always does feel weird to be the only like Native in your class. Like, that's why I'm lucky to be in. Last year I got lucky and he was in 2 classes with Nate. This year I got 1 class with him. So in like a lot of my classes, I'm usually, you know, it's mostly white.
So when you do, I guess one of the nicest things about developing some sort of, you know, confederacy amongst this intertribal group like Arrow or ACES is you get to come together and lean on each other for support. But also, at least at UWSP, we have a few events and opportunities where the Native students get together and they showcase some things for the campus or for the community. Can you tell me about any big events that happen that are sponsored by the Native American groups or students that are out there? What's kind of a big event that happens each year?
Well, we have the Arrow Powwow. It's going on for over 40 years.
What is Arrow?
Arrow is American Indians Reaching for Opportunity. It used to be American Indians Resisting Ostracism.
What? What? That's a big word.
Yeah, Jeannie Day came up with that name.
Oh,
bless her soul.
Yeah, and she was a profound advocate and an activist and amazing, kind of the matriarch of UWSP. And so there's not a lot of things that got by her. So she's amazing. So I'm going to sing the AIM song in my head right now, thinking of her. So anything else that goes on each year? I mean, I see you guys do like fundraisers, right? You got Maya whipping up some fry bread, right?
No,
you're not.
That's Auntie Nettie.
That's Auntie Nettie, yeah. Huh? Well, Auntie's always got the best fry bread and the best boyfriends. anything else?
Well, since we started, we're trying to make it known in the Native American Center to have a winter storytelling night annually. So this will be the second annual storytelling night. And then we are trying to do more celebrations for Indigenous Peoples Day each year.
Well, that sounds fun. They always do winter stories in the winter because they'd just be really weird to do winter stories in the summer. So, but I mean, that's kind of a Native thing. So just don't ask. So being a student is often a difficult thing. Are you guys like making lots of money from financial aid? You guys pretty rich?
Yeah.
You guys doing pretty good?
That's a funny one.
How many of you guys are like really like living it up right now? Eating well, driving nice cars. No, it's a lot of work. But you're going to school, and typically after you get your degree, you can improve your livelihood because there's more opportunities. But you're not going to go right to work after school. Some of you are thinking about going to school after school. Is that correct? Like, anyone want to go on to further school, get their master's, get another bachelor's degree?
I do.
Rio, your friend circle is full of college students. Are you thinking about college already?
Yes.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I want to go to college, and I want to get a doctorate, and I want to be a psychiatrist.
No kidding. What, are you going to do that in Stevens Point?
Probably not.
Probably not? Where are you thinking of living?
Well, like living for college? Or
living for the rest of your life.
Well, I want to live in Rhode Island.
Rhode Island? So I just need to know, because that's where your parents are moving, if that's the case. Anyone going on to grad school, Forrest?
Yeah, I'm Forrest. I'm a HBW major. That's health promotion and wellness. Initially came in just so I could kind of give back to the community, maybe the Native community, and try to offer health advice or health support, health promotion. And I would maybe like to go into graduate school to maybe do something in rehabilitation or physical therapy or possibly worksite wellness. Wow. Just somewhere to give back to the community and get our health back up to par.
So you brought something up that's kind of important. It probably could be a lifelong discussion here. But some of you are going to school, becoming educated, and have intent to go back to your own communities and serve. A lot of people that do go to college from the Native community may not go back to their own hometowns because there just isn't the job opportunity that you went to school with. There isn't the pay that you went, you know, that you need to cover all your student debt. And there's really no hope of making a livelihood in that small community. Does that seem right for each of you in your different homelands, your reservations, that it's hard to find opportunities?
I'd say yes. My post-graduation plans are either to pursue a Master's of Fine Arts, either in Minnesota or Michigan, because I'd like to go out there to somewhere that's familiar with Native people, but yet still different from Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. So it's hard to find opportunity on a reservation or in a homeland or a community, but is part of your charge not to look for opportunity, but to create opportunity?
It's a little bit of both, because like you said, it's hard to find those opportunities in Indigenous communities, but those are often the places that need those positions the most. Mm. So naturally you want to go and help other people. And regardless if that's in your community or another one, you know, that's something that you should be doing.
So as younger college students, do you feel like there's a desire to have you back in the community, or do you feel like you kind of got to fight your way in and find your place?
I think sometimes it's funny in tribal jobs where they'll want you to have an education, but often they hire white people instead of looking at their own Native community members. And so sometimes, like, I worked in my hometown and I loved working at a school, but a lot of people didn't take me seriously because I was an Indigenous woman.
Hmm. Well, we cannot end on that note, because humor is a part of how we get by a lot of our stresses. And one of the nice things about even an intertribal community like this little bitty campus town here in this little bitty home, we have a universal humor that, you know, keeps us on our toes and keeps us supporting each other. So so we use that to support one another. We use that to share intertribally. But there's all kinds of other ways that we connect, not just through humor, but through primarily what we do every month. We have family dinner night and we connect through food. And we're not always clubbing buffaloes and you know, shooting some of the city squirrels and deer. We're having pizza sometimes, and we're just kicking back. And it's how does that feel? Does that feel a little bit like home? I hope so. Yeah.
Most definitely. It feels warm. It feels nice to be around people that just make you smile and laugh the whole time you're there.
Well, we're happy to have you. So that fills our time for this evening's show. I want to thank the Native Roots Radio, Robert and Wendy and Curtis for allowing us to come on here. These young students, they're very active and very energetic. They're enthusiastic. They bring life to this home. So we couldn't have done this particular show without them. We will close a little bit on what some call a round robin, and we're going to share a little bit. I'm going to ask him one question, one-liner, two-liner, whatever. Any closing thoughts? In those closing thoughts, send a message to some young Indigenous students who are thinking about going on to college. So what message do you have for them?
I think my message first off would be don't let life get you down. So, I mean, there's going to be a lot of different injustices and things and struggles that you're going to face. But the thing is to just persevere through them. You got to accept it. You can't let it get you down, because, I mean, there is what is and there's what isn't. I mean, you have to kind of accept what is, because what isn't didn't happen. So you got to either make it happen and move on, or you're going to struggle.
I'd say go to college or trade school, either one. Bring that prosperity that you learn how to do for whatever subject you're going into, and bring that back into your communities. Really, we need to become as sovereign as we can, as self-reliant as we can. And like the previous guy just said, don't let anything bring you down. I mean, we have such immense adversity that no one else, no other, like non-Indigenous communities, not a lot of them, have the same adversity we can have that we're capable of.
Yeah, one thing I'd mention is if you're going to go to college, don't be afraid of failure. Or don't be afraid to go back at a different time. It doesn't have to be right when you're done with high school. And you'll find yourself in college if you just take it seriously and actually put your effort into it. Just don't be afraid.
Now, my advice would be that the support that you're looking for is going to be there in college, so don't be afraid to try to find it. You know, perseverance in your blood, so follow your ways.
My advice would be to create your own path. I would say that you should find out what makes you happy in life and find out your passions and pursue them with all you have.
Apply for scholarships.
I would say don't let your heritage bring you down and use it as a building block to keep you up.
My hope is that people are able to think about what makes them happy and what they can put back into the world to make it a better place. And if college is that for you, there will be people there to help you along the way.
I would say that not everybody's college experience is linear, and your experience isn't going to look like everybody else's, so don't worry about what others are doing. Worry about what's best for you and what you feel that you should do in the future.
Everything that you said was enjoyable. I want to thank all of my friends here that are working through college. We just get one night in a rare time to sit down and get the pressures of work and homework off and enjoy ourselves as Indigenous people. I want to thank once again folks at Native Roots Radio. This is John Greendeer, Mosh Huska, signing off and hoping to hit you guys again next week. All right, have a good one.
What a great segment. Thank you, John Greendeer. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and we'll be right back after this short break.
Nation.
You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is The Best Of. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is The Best Of.
Hi, I'm Jane Sanders, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
Welcome back to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Robert Pilot. Interview that we wanted to do earlier, and he just is luckily just got through the airport, through security. We have Alan Roy, and Alan, welcome to Pilot's Progressive Party.
Hi, this is Alan. How you doing, Robert?
Doing good, doing good. Hey, can you tell us our audience a little bit about you? I know you're going to be running for an important office coming soon in District 2. Can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Great. Thanks for having me on. Bonjour, Dinoa, Wabashki, Mayingan, Indigo, Secretary Treasurer Alan Roy, Migi Kanem Guyan, Gaye, Mongan Dode, Ode Mini Zagaganing, and Dunjaba, Gawaba, Biganakagish Koniganing. For those of us who don't speak Ojibwe, my name is White Wolf. I'm from the Loon Clan, but I'm also known as Secretary Treasurer Alan Roy. I'm originally from Strawberry Lake on White Earth Reservation. And I have been serving on the White Earth Tribal Council since about July of 2018 when I was elected. And this fall, currently right now as well, I am running for the State Senate District 2 seat, which is currently held by Paul Utke. He's a Republican. I am seeking the DFL endorsement. We do have caucuses next Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And so if you're up in the district or you got family or friends, please tell them to show up to M State. It starts at, the caucus starts at 7, but registration starts at 6:30. And so I'm happy to discuss what I believe to be great initiatives that we can do for our folks up in the district, but for Minnesota and Indigenous people everywhere.
Cool.
I'm really happy to be on the show, by the way. Thank you for having me on.
What kind of policies do you want to have changed?
Sure.
Or brought about, new policies brought about?
Say again?
Or new policies to be brought about?
Sure. So I've focused my campaign on three areas. One of them is economic development. Another one that I was discussing with the folks in the district is healthcare related. And the third area is natural resources. And so the big thing that I'm working on right now related to the economy, which I think is really important for our part of the state, is renewable energies. And so certainly we have these pipelines coming through right through the district there. And so what I'm saying is that we need to propose more sustainable solutions. And so just right now, like, this is why I'm at the airport. I went out and I visited a hydroelectric plant down here in Rock Island. I went down here to tour it just to take a look at, using, the waterways as the clean source of energy. Certainly we're looking at solar power, we're looking at wind power, we're looking at a lot of things. Even just last week, we were out in Washington, D.C., White Earth Nation was. And we were talking with the U.S. Department of Energy, and they have a lot of programs out there for tribes and for folks that are interested in doing this sort of work. And so I'd like to bring a lot of those resources to the district.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some work that needs to be done in the state, certainly with that, mm-hmm. Especially with the regulatory end. And so I think through a collaborative approach between the tribes and the counties and in the state of Minnesota, that we can build a better future together. And for the healthcare, I was just I met Quinn. Quinn, she's running for Pete Stauber's seat,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's CD8,
mm-hmm.
Congressional District 8. She was talking about insulin prices and. I know, and especially in our community, the Indigenous community, a lot of our folks, they have a lot of diabetes. They have a lot of issues with that. And, you know, certainly, you know, a lot of our folks can get care through Indian Health Service,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of our folks, they don't have access to those facilities, or they may be a descendant and they're not necessarily enrolled in a tribal nation.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not able to access these resources. And so working on those prices in the state of Minnesota, I think, should be a priority,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that we can fix. And as far as the natural resources go, I'm a big proponent of protecting our natural resources. You know, just recently we have, I'll just use setbacks on homes, right? So mm-hmm. a lot of folks, they would like to build a lake home. This is a real world example. They want to build a lake home. They, you know, build it too close to the lake and they don't consider the effects that that's going to have on there.
Mm-hmm.
The ecology of the lake, the biology of the lake. And so I think there should be more clear legislation around that. I know if you go in some parts of the state, certainly that's managed by the county, but I think there should be something more uniform to help protect our resources. Wow. And myself, the other thing is I'm a veteran.
Right, I was going to mention that.
Armed Forces. Yeah, and so that's another thing I was talking with the folks in the district that I think there's a lot of resources out there for them, but I always push folks to do better. And I think we as a state, we can do a little bit better helping our tribal, not just our tribal, but all our veterans, not just the veterans, but their families.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was on tribal council, that's one of the very first things that I took care of was the veteran community. We didn't even have a formal policy set up for our veterans. And so that was the first thing that one of the very first things that I took care of by creating benefits and even for our reservists and guardsmen. And then we took that same policy and we brought it to the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, where I serve as on the Tribal Executive Committee. And they also adopted a similar policy. So I think we can do a lot better with mm-hmm. our veterans. I know in the indigenous community, less than 50% of our veterans that get discharged from active duty actually apply for and or receive
mm-hmm.
VA resources. So there's a definite need there. And I think that we can do a lot better with it.
Alan,
There's a lot of other issues that we're working on too.
Alan, I'd like to have you on again real soon. We're down to 10 seconds here. This is Alan Roy, and you're running for House Representative District 2. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. We're going to have you on again.
He possessed a race. possession, a war that doesn't end. Children of God, feed on children of earth. Days people don't care for people. These days are the hardest. Material fields, material harvest. Decoration on chain that binds. Mirrors gold. The people lose their minds. Sell the earth, the people walk on. We are the land.
I would like to end with these thoughts. If you are listening to the show, you are the resistance. From Chief Plenicoops, the ground on which we stand on is sacred ground. It is the blood of our ancestors. We need to resist, divest, join a group, run for office. You've been listening to Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake, and I've been your host, Robert Pilot. The revolution is kicking into high gear, and I would like to thank all my listening audience, our sponsors, and especially our guests, which make this show. If you are listening to this show, you are the resistance. We're still here. We are the seventh generation. Free Leonard Peltier.